The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. We take a hard look at education in our country and the effort to change it dramatically in some schools as they seek to implement critical race theory.
In America, you cannot treat people differently because of their skin color.
And our nation's largest teachers union has gotten solidly behind the efforts to defend those seeking the change.
Everything good the NEA, your kids' teachers, wish to destroy. But you will continue to send your kids to school, and you won't fight.
Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton gives advice on how to put a stop to it all.
There may be no bigger payoff in American politics than being on your local school board.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And please follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program at Town Hall Review. Parents have been frustrated with the direction of education for some time now. It's drifted left over decades as liberals have fought to increase their influence on curriculum nationwide. The move was gradual, but it's been clear. Something changed recently. Progressives have gained a tremendous amount of control, and they don't work quite like the liberals of the past. Progressives are far less patient, and their work has caught the attentions of parents nationwide. From critical race theory to gender issues, the far left is pushing an aggressive agenda on schools and communities across our nation. Grade school children are coming home with shocking material that have taken those parents off the sidelines and into school board meetings. Their gloves are off. I discussed the growing uprising against PCC, politically correct curriculum, with Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton on The Hugh Hewitt Show. In the Washington Post, there are two stories. Loudoun County parents upset with their school board over a number of issues, including transgenderism. And in the state of Texas, your colleagues Cruz and Cornyn will know about this. The lieutenant governor ordered canceled at the Texas State Museum a disparaging museum program on the Alamo, calling it a myth. These are both PCCs, politically correct content or curriculum cases, PC3. Is this actually a thing, or is it just a media thing, Senator?
No, Hugh, regrettably, it is a real problem in school districts across the country. Obviously, and in some very liberal jurisdiction, it's worse than it is, say, in most places here in Arkansas. Loudoun County, though, has just gone around the bend. If you follow that story, they've got school board members and administrators who are surveilling parents on social media who object to their children being indoctrinated with, you know, critical race theory or radical gender theories or other Marxist theories. I think most parents want their kids to learn the basic skills they need to succeed in the world. They want them to learn about our past so we can build on our great successes and we can correct some of our flaws. They don't want to see their kids indoctrinated and sometimes have that indoctrination hidden from them and have the people who are doing the indoctrinating, whether it's the administrators, the teachers, or what have you, attack them for. That's why you see so many people running for school board races that are normally somewhat sleepy affairs around the country. And I would encourage all your listeners, if you want to make a difference in your community, make a difference for our kids' future, look at what's happening in your school district. If you don't like it, run for school board. In terms of the amount of time and energy and money invested in a political campaign versus the impact you can have, there may be no bigger payoff in American politics than being on your local school board.
Now, Senator, I think there are two camps. Those that want education to be objective and merit-based, and those who want something else. And so there's critical race theory, there's Marxism, there's critical gender theory, there's critical legal theory, there's all sorts of non-objective theories, and then there's everybody else. And I think the former, For example, I have CNN up on my screen. Race Deconstructed. Sign up to learn about race in America and the role it plays in culture, politics, and more. Well, I'm not signing up for that newsletter, and I don't want that to be in the school. I want the schools to be about academic excellence and to be blind to issues of race and gender. I think that's a majoritarian position. In fact, I think it's a super majoritarian position. Do you agree?
Yeah, I have no question about that, Hugh, that the vast majority of Americans of all races want to live up to the promise of colorblindness in our society. What Dr. Martin Luther King said in his dream speech, that we should be judged by the content of our character, not by the color of our skin, a speech in which he repeatedly and explicitly invoked the Declaration of Independence and our founding principles. He viewed his work in the civil rights movement not as a repudiation of America, but as a full realization of its promise. That's contrary to all these radical leftists today who want to teach our kids to hate America. We want to teach them that it's founded not on freedom, but in bondage. That is not what the vast majority of Americans want. And if you look at schools, too, you've got schools that are intentionally harming high-performing students. Again, look up in Northern Virginia. You've got schools like Thomas Jefferson, which I think is in Fairfax, not Loudoun. I'm not sure.
It's yes.
One of the most selective, prestigious public high schools in America. I think they've started to drop AP classes or advanced math or even the test to get into it. Let's just be blunt and call a spade because they think they have too many Asian kids at school. They are going to objectively harm the prospects of hardworking, high-achieving Asian kids because they don't like the racial balance in their schools. Nothing could be more un-American.
Now, I got a direct message from a retired Navy captain earlier today. Good for covering PC3. A free people cannot survive the persistent attempt to teach its youth that their nation is vile. That's succinct. I also believe it's true. Do you?
Of course, Hugh. I mean, Ronald Reagan used to say that we are only one generation away from the extinction of freedom. It is not like the color of your eyes. You don't pass it down as a heritable trait. A society has customs and traditions and habits and a culture. But those things can deteriorate very rapidly if you teach an entire generation of children to despise them, that they are corrupt, that they are irredeemable. That's one reason why it's so important that we protect our schools and the curriculum that our kids see. It's another reason why I've fought back so hard against these kind of critical race training sessions in the military. Who's going to raise their hand and take an oath to fight and perhaps die for our Constitution if they think that Constitution is inherently racist, fundamentally flawed, and irredeemable?
In the middle of the critical race theory debate, the National Education Association took a side. As one might expect, it was that of the far left. Here's Dennis Prager.
Listen to this. You have to hear this. This is an official statement of the National Education Association that the curricula should involve a critique of empire, white supremacy, anti-blackness, anti-indigeneity, racism, patriarchy, and here's my favorite, cis-heteropatriarchy. Do you know what cis-heteropatriarchy is? I'll tell you what it is. Men identifying as men and marrying women and making nuclear families based on that. Capitalism, capitalism. Ableism. Racism is discrimination on the basis of race. Ableism is discrimination on the basis of ability. But I don't understand. I mean, if you have one leg, you can't play first base. Is that ableist? I'm very serious. Is that an example of ableism? That I would not be admitted into a marathon. Is that an example of ableism? Anthropocentrism, that is human-centered points of view, and other forms of power and oppression of the intersections of society. So you understand everything good
the NEA your kids' teachers wish to destroy, but you will continue to send your kids to school and you won't fight, then with great compassion, I mean it, I just say you deserve the consequences of the type of human being the schools will make. If you don't fight and you don't take your child out, they're announcing. They're not hiding what they want to do. Do you realize that? They will critique anthropocentrism. That means the belief that humans are the most valuable creature. They will critique. Well, of course they will, because they don't believe that humans are created in God's image. We religious people have such quaint views, and they have contempt for us and our religion. They proclaim what they'll do. They don't hide it. If it's healthy and good, they wish to destroy it. National Education Association, the largest teachers' union, again. They will provide an already created in-depth study that critiques empire, white supremacy, anti-blackness, anti-indigeneity, racism, patriarchy, cis-heteropatriarchy, capitalism, ableism, human-centered points of view, and other points of power and oppression. In addition to its plans, the NEA will join with Black Lives Matter at school and the Zinn Education Project. How's that? Howard Zinn. Had him on the show before he died. His America is a Piece of Crap History is the most widely used history text in America's schools. President Becky Pringle, shocking, a woman, has also agreed to make public statements in support of critical race theory and racial honesty in education, quote unquote. According to Pringle's bio in the NEA website, she is a middle school science teacher with 31 years of teaching experience and a fierce, quote, fierce social justice warrior, defender of educator rights, and unrelenting advocate for all students and communities of color, and a valued and respected voice in the education arena. She's one of the few people of whom it could be said they truly made society worse. Will any teachers speak up against this hate civilization agenda? I doubt it. Cowardice is a qualification for anything in academia, especially colleges.
Coming up.
In America, you cannot treat people differently because of their skin color.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. In the Chicago area, one teacher refused to teach critical race theory. Stacey DeMar has been an educator in District 65 for two decades, and she believes the new emphasis on race is bad for students and teachers alike. She has taken the district to court. Kimberly Herman of the Southern Legal Foundation is representing DeMar. Herman recently joined Dan Prof and fill-in host Jeannie Ives on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
So give us sort of the four corners of the suit and your assessment of the prospects of the suit's success.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like you said, I mean, District 65 is really ground zero for the kind of race-based programming that you went through and that you listed and that we have in our complaint. And at the end of the day, it is illegal, it violates our civil rights laws, and it's unconstitutional, it violates the Equal Protection Clause. because, you know, these schools seem to forget that they are arms of the government, right? Public schools are arms of the government. And we as parents know that they have the authority and the power. So in order to check that power, we have to go to the courtroom. And, you know, our client is very brave and she feels very strongly about this, as do many other people who have come forward in just the last 2 days since we filed this lawsuit. And, you know, the crux of our lawsuit is bringing forth the well-settled law that in America, you cannot treat people differently because of their skin color, right? It's what we call equality. I like to always kind of remind people of that, that equality is enshrined in the Constitution, and that is what this lawsuit is about. It is not, equality is not the same as equity, which is, as you mentioned, what the district has been pushing for many, many years now. The way that we see equity is that it's a license to punish Americans for their skin color,
yeah.
Right? And that's why we had the Civil Rights Movement in the first place. That's why the U.S. Supreme Court struck down school segregation in 1954. It is wrong, it is morally wrong, and it is legally wrong. And for the life of me, I cannot understand why District 65 wants to put us back 70 years when we had National Guardsmen coming in to enforce these segregation orders. Instead, they're actually segregating teachers and students. And so, you know, in a nutshell, that's really what the lawsuit is about. It is about equality, and it is about holding District 65 accountable to the Constitution.
You said other people have come forward since it was public that the suit had been filed. Other people, meaning like other teachers, are they supportive of Stacey DeMar, or they're wanting to file similar suits in other districts? What's the response? What do you mean by that response?
Yeah, well, we for months and really, I mean, before this became a massive national issue, which I'm so glad that it has. We have been talking to parents and teachers across the country, and this is the first in a series of lawsuits that Southeastern Legal Foundation is going to be filing in Illinois and in other states throughout the country. But, yeah, we have had, to be honest, overwhelming and support from the local community there, which to a degree was unexpected because, you know, our client has been fighting this battle for years. She filed a complaint with the Department of Education back in 2019. And in January of this year, the Department of Education actually found, they formally found, that District 65 violated federal civil rights laws. And 2 days, 3 days after Biden was inaugurated, the Department of Education withdrew that letter of finding with no explanation.
Right, of course.
Civil laws have been the same. Civil rights laws have been the same since 1964. They've only gotten stronger. And
for some reason, apparently, they all
changed the day that Biden became our president.
I wonder why that is. Golly gee. Yeah, administrations change and interpretations change along with them, don't they?
Well,
Has
there been an uproar in Evanston? There has been in other suburbs, parents going to the school boards talking about this issue, school boards and superintendents denying that they're doing this. But Evanston's pretty woke. I mean, they instituted reparations even prior to this. The school district was, charged that they were going to actually they were going to have a racist reopening policy, so to speak. So do you see any pushback from the local community there in Evanston?
I certainly expect there to be some. I believe that, you know, there have been maybe a statement made out there by the PTSA president to this point. But, you know, I think a lot of it, of the silence has come from fear to speak out, and also a lack of awareness as to what was actually going on. I mean, if you want to talk locally, we have parents that are interested in joining the suit. We have had other teachers come forward that are interested in joining the suit. Certainly did not expect that, because there have been parents who have spoken out about this at school board meetings in the past, but not to the level that we're seeing, you know, like in Loudoun County or some of the other places that have kind of gone viral around the country. You know, but when you look at this curriculum and you see that at the end of the day, what it's teaching is it's teaching and trying to get non-white kids to hate, and it's trying to get white kids to hate themselves. It is startling. It makes you stop in your tracks, in addition to the fact that it's unconstitutional. And I had a number of parents say to me, I had no idea. I know they talk about equity. I didn't understand what that meant. I didn't understand it was just a euphemism for critical race theory, for all of these other things. and really for conditioning individuals to see their skin, to see each other's skin color first. And that is not what we should be teaching. We should be teaching to look at the inside of a person.
Now,
look at who person is.
For people listening to this who have kids in private school, because these elite private schools are right. in many cases worse than the government school systems, because, of course, you have these, the Chardonnay Antifa and the champagne socialists who send their kids to these $60,000 a year schools. Like Grace Church School in New York, and that math teacher, Paul Rossi, who made a splash by saying, I didn't come to the school. I'm not to treat my students differently based on the race. I'm not going to do it. And he was summarily dismissed. And he had tried to go through the proper channels and get some, redress to what was being promoted. And he was unable to do so. So he went public and he gets fired. Private school parents, like we have a very high-profile case going on at Loyola Academy, which is a Catholic school on the North Shore of Chicago, as you probably know. What's your advice and counsel for private school parents dealing with the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, there may be recourse for private school parents in the contract terms that they have. And I believe that there's going to be some groups out there that are going to try to kind of push the needle on that with private schools. But our focus here at Southeastern Legal Foundation really is public schools. We're a nonprofit, a 501c3, and our mission is to hold the government accountable when they violate the Constitution. So, my advice to those parents is speak up. Get involved, be involved on the boards. My children are in private school personally, and I cannot subject them to this. Just stay as involved as you can and be an advocate for your children. And, if they're not going to listen, take your money somewhere else.
So your sort of prognosis on this case and what this battle is going to look like, give people some perspective in terms of just how difficult this fight is going to be.
The universe of these teacher trainings specifically out there is fairly small. And so it's really making sure that we, bring cases in the right places, and that when we get the court to declare that these trainings and that this curriculum is unconstitutional, we believe that's going to have a ripple effect throughout the country.
Coming up, Lonnie Chen seeks to make California a better place to live.
Part of this is being able to hold people accountable. We just haven't had that in Sacramento in a very long time.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. The state of California appears to be a deep blue nightmare for many people. Democrats enjoy supermajorities in both houses of the legislature. There's very little left to stop a far-left agenda anywhere in the state. But one statewide position is able, at very least, to monitor and, if need be, expose out-of-control spending, waste, fraud, and abuse. The state's controller. My friend Lonnie Chen is running to be that very person. And he's capable of making a huge difference in California. I spoke with him on the Hugh Hewitt Show. You're running in California, Lonnie. Why?
Well, I have been somebody who I grew up in California. I grew up in Southern California. I live in California now. I look at what the state was when I was growing up here. I look at what it is now, and I realize that we can be doing so much better. And in particular, I look at the way we're handling these big problems we have in California, Hugh, and you understand this. We have a cost of living crisis. We have an economic crisis. We have a homelessness and housing crisis. All of these things, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. We've got a whole host of other issues. And unfortunately, we're not solving big problems here anymore. And so for me, part of this challenge is how can I get in there and help address these problems? How can I get there and help solve these problems? The Office of Comptroller is an interesting one. It's a wonky kind of office. Not a lot of people spend time thinking about it. But the comptroller is the chief fiscal officer, the chief financial officer of the state of California. And it's somebody who potentially can get in there and have impact on all of these different issues. And the impact can come through transparency, through helping taxpayers in California understand this is how your money is being spent or misspent. And these are the kinds of changes we need to make to improve how we're doing on these basic problems. So this is an office that excites me. I think it's a great opportunity to address these problems, and I'm excited for the race ahead.
You know, Lonnie, so am I. And I'll give you a perfect example. In February, I attended a hearing on Skid Row in L.A. and about the homeless crisis in Los Angeles. And Judge Carter was presiding, and he kept asking, where did the money go? Because they passed a bond measure and a county bond measure and a city bond measure, and there were special taxes and assessments totaling over $1 billion. That they really couldn't account for. No one could give an account. Is that something the comptroller would look into?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, the comptroller has the ability to look at any spending of state dollars, whether it happens at the state level or with a locality, a local agency. And we know that we have spent upwards of $50 billion trying to fight the homeless crisis over these last several years. And, you know, I was in L.A. just recently in downtown Los Angeles, and it is heartbreaking to see how bad this problem has become. We don't have any sense of where all this spending has gone. The comptroller can go in and basically audit any agency at any time for any reason, produce the results of that audit, recommend improvements. And this is the most important thing, Hugh. The comptroller can then say, you've got to get stuff done by a certain date. If you don't get it done by that date, then I am going to publicly call each of you out for failing to meet your obligation as a public official. That, to me, is the most exciting part of this, is being able to hold people accountable. We just haven't had that in Sacramento in a very long time.
Are you? Do you have authority if you win over CalPERS and their woke politics and their socially conscious but disastrous investment policies?
The comptroller actually has a seat on the board of both the California Pension Public Employee Retirement System, which is CalPERS, as well as the state teacher retirement system, which is CalSTRS. The comptroller sits on both boards and has a statutory seat. So the comptroller cannot be removed, even if they disagree with what you're trying to do in terms of creating more transparency, helping people understand better the shape these pension funds are in. You know, I think if most Californians realize that the shape these pension funds are in and just how big of a bill is coming due, they would be so much more concerned about these funds than you know, most people recognize. And I think the comptroller has a very important role to play in terms of ensuring people understand, here's what's going on at these big pension funds, here's what you need to know, and here's why you should care.
The third one is the California State University system and the University of California system. Both of them are deeply in debt. Both of them have squandered billions. Both of them are terribly managed on many, many fronts. Does the comptroller have any role in either of those or both?
Yeah. You know, this is another example of where you have state spending that has not been looked after in the right way. These are, in many ways, the crown jewels of our national higher education system in the United States. We've got the University of California and the California State University system. But unfortunately, here again, you have a lot of spending that has not been well accounted for, that has not been thought through. And the comptroller has the opportunity here again to show people, hey, here's what we're doing, here's why we should care about what we're doing, and here is the way to provoke change.
Go to townhallreview.com to hear the entire conversation with Lonnie Chen. Coming up, politically incorrect science gets buried.
It's not racism. It is simply the reality.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. For centuries, science ran fairly independent of social feelings. That has changed dramatically as now scientific groups have been forced to follow politically correct protocols, and funding depends upon it. Heather McDonald, author of The Diversity Delusion, is exposing the danger of it all. She explained the details to my friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
The idea that race and sex are relevant to scientific research has now completely infected the federal science bureaucracies and most academic departments. And most recent iteration of this, the National Institutes of Health, which is the premier funder of basic research in biology, in medicine, has declared that its neuroscience initiative, this is a cutting-edge, incredibly sophisticated initiative that involves nanotechnology, you know, high-tech physics to try and image what goes on in the brain, to try and understand the electrical circuitry, that from here on out, if you want to get a grant to work on this brain initiative whose possible yield is cures for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, depression, autism, you have to show that your team is going to have a suitable smattering of underrepresented populations, whether minorities, whether blacks, Hispanics, poor people, single mothers. You have to draw from so-called community-based organizations, which usually means like a homeless shelter or something. You know, if you're community-based, you're some nonprofit, you know, eating off of the government dime. And your score on your plan for enhancing diversity will affect whether you get funded or not. Now, the big fallacy of the race hustle here and in every other environment, every other corporation or in criminal law, is that it ignores what's in the pipeline. And to say, as the director of the NIH does, Francis Collins, that because blacks are 12-13% of the population, but they only make up about 2% of people receiving grants from the NIH, that must mean that the NIH and other science generally suffers from structural racism, is completely unscientific. It is an utter lie. The problem is that there is a huge academic skills gap. We know from research, black students do homework at a quarter the rate of Asians and half the rate of whites. Their math SATs, which are a big indicator of whether you're going to end up as a scientist later on, are utterly rock bottom. The average math SAT on an 800-point scale for blacks is 454, which is a standard deviation at least below that of Asians and whites. Very few blacks even reach the score that will predict that they get at least a C-plus in their freshman year science or math courses. And if you can't muster even a C-plus in your freshman year pre-calculus, you're not going to end up working on the NIH's neurology initiative. And then when you look at the PhDs that are graduating in science, here's some numbers, Dennis. In 2019, there were 20 blacks nationwide who received a doctorate in a neuroscience field. That's less than 2% of all such degrees awarded in the neurosciences. So when this Francis Collins, this head of the NIH, who has gone around saying he's not even going to participate in science conferences unless they have a lot of females and minorities on the panels, because otherwise it's a mantle, which is completely taboo now. When he complains that NIH only awards about 2% of its grants to blacks, that's completely in line with the rate at which blacks receive PhDs in the STEM fields. It is not racism. In electrical engineering, which is a feeder into nanotechnology, which is now, as I say, at the cutting edge of understanding the brain, there were, of all PhDs in the field, there were 18 black PhDs in electrical engineering last year. That's 1% of the total. It's not racism. It is simply the reality.
There's nothing one can say to all of that, except to ask you what is the obvious. I think the question is obvious. I hope the answer is not, but it might be as well. What will this do to science?
It will absolutely crush it under the weight of mediocrity. It is mathematically proven that when you introduce extraneous criteria into a selection process, so it is extraneous. If you want to work on a cure for Alzheimer's, whether you're female, black, Hispanic, gay, whatever, is extraneous. The only thing that matters is your scientific expertise. But if you say we have to start selecting for these extraneous criteria, you will lower your pool of employees. It is inevitable. And so we are going to weight our scientific enterprise down with dead weight. Guess who is not? China. China, in the field of science at least, is ruthlessly meritocratic. It doesn't give a damn if a lab is all male. If it's all female, who cares? The only thing that matters is it's filled with our best.
That's right. Is there anything left that is that has not been hurt or even destroyed by the left? Is there anything left?
I don't really know. How do we ensure that the next generation has some people in it that are still understand the value of reason? And so the need is on. It's urgent to try to create alternative institutions. Donors should be, for God's sakes, no listener to your show should give a dime to his alma mater. Save your money, and let's hope that some entrepreneur comes up with a way to make homeschooling more feasible or create schools that are dedicated to a non-angry, grateful teaching of Western civilization, because we need to create alternatives to preserve, because otherwise it's all coming down. It is, every institution is going to be felled by the concept of disparate impact. We need to create alternative institutions.
Coming up, the issues that delayed the repair of the condominiums that collapsed so dramatically and tragically in Florida.
In light of what happened, it was a trivial thing. It seemed so incredibly small.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day.
This week, a school board calls the police on parents objecting to political correctness taught in the schools.
It was deemed an unlawful assembly.
The Biden administration puts a scare into the economy.
Goods are becoming more rare. There's a ton of cash in the marketplace chasing these limited goods, and that's how inflation happens.
The latest COVID variant has some people worried all over again.
If we truly knew what Romans 13 said, we would not be so quick to go along with everything the state tells us to do.
Embrace yourself, football fans.
NFL declares football is gay.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The collapse of the condos in Surfside, Florida is a shock to the senses. You simply don't expect that here in the United States, where structures of that size undergo a tremendous amount of scrutiny before they are deemed up to code. In the days since, it's been discovered there was concern years before the buildings came down. There were structural issues that needed to be addressed. But bickering, cost, and red tape got in the way. I discussed the troubling issues with the Washington Examiner's Byron York.
The most interesting story right now, Byron, is actually an anti-government story. When people dive into Surfside, they're going to find a local government indifferent and simply inattentive to the ordinary course of business. I began to read the Journal story on this yesterday, and it's every single permitting decision I ever had was left a trail of emails like that, begging, pleading, cajoling, threatening established government figures to do their jobs. And I don't think that the elite media is going to want to dive too deeply into this because they're going to find failures of government at every turn. In other words, that's not politically correct content. That is not the kind of curriculum they're going to teach in schools, which is an anti-government, a suspicion of government, and a tradition of liberty.
Well, actually, I have to agree with that. And the Surfside, I mean, the Surfside question is one of simple good government. That is the kind of good government story that I can certainly understand the press emphasizing. It's what I want to read. I mean, I'm interested in finding out about this. But it doesn't carry a political message. It's vastly more important in terms of the people affected than issues of pronouns. It's something.
Let's focus on that, Byron. City engineering and government responsiveness is far more important than transgendered issues. But everybody has a stake in local governments. But if they hear Loudoun County or they hear Surfside, they sort of turn it off except for Surfside's drama. They don't want that. That's a local news thing. The transgender thing is an ideological content and critical race theory, subset of critical legal theory, that's of, by, for the left, period.
Absolutely defined by the left. But the collapse of the building in Surfside made it an issue that transcends all of that stuff. It made it an important issue for everybody.
You watch and I will watch for how many stories follow up on the building's engineers' request for a curb cut to add 5 to 7 spaces. That is a very minor request, and it languished.
Parking is a huge issue. I mean, it really is. And obviously, in light of what happened, it was a trivial thing. It seems so incredibly small. But, I mean, there are intense fights about parking in every crowded area in America.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Pichon, Adam Ramsey, Michael Cook, Ben Brigman, Harley Eide, Alex Perez, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.